some of the goals of engineering should always be to make things simple. Fewer parts, less money is really the end work. And, you know, when you make things simple, first of all, it saves you a lot of work building it. I used to say I'm lazy. I didn't want to wire as many parts together. If I can design it with fewer parts, it's easier to build. Okay? But it takes an awful lot of thinking. Thinking. How can I use a different part that was designed for one thing to do this task? Better yet, how can I take a portion of my design and use it in one place and use it in a second place at the same time rather than design a second part? And how can I save chips? These kind of mentalities, it takes a lot of mind work, a lot of thinking. You have to be very dedicated. You have to have a reason. I had a personal reason in my life to always make things with the fewest parts any human could come up with, so I had it kind of easy. For example, on the Apple I computer, which really gave away the formula for personal computers, the size of a typewriter, a keyboard you type on, and a video display. Every computer since the Apple I has had that format. Every computer before the Apple I had a big front panel of awful switches and lights and buttons with meanings that no normal human being would understand. You had to be a computer expert to come close to touching it. But the Apple I had to have memory. And Steve Jobs had come down to the computer club and seen where I was giving it away. He lived up in Oregon, away from technology. He came down and he said, "Let's start a company." And I said, "Well, I work for Hewlett-Packard. I wouldn't ever start a company behind their back. I'm too loyal." And I approached Hewlett-Packard with it first, and they turned me down 5 times overall. So Steve and I had our little company, and he said, "Well," I showed him, "the way I made it affordable, I used this new thing called the 4K dynamic memory. 8 chips have enough memory to run programming languages where you can type in programs to solve chess problems or whatever you want to do, and out comes the answer." And 8 chips did it, whereas the other approach, all the other little guys trying to start little companies and come up with a formula for a microcomputer, were using 32 of the older style of chips called static memories. And Steve said to me, "Well, why'd you choose the ones you did?" I said, "Well, some guy was selling them cheap at the club." And he said, "Well, what'd you consider Intel?" I said, "I could never afford Intel. Too expensive. You know how much they charge? They charge $400 just for a microprocessor." And Steve said, "Well, what if I can get them for free?" I said, "Oh, if you can get them for free, that's great, because the Intel parts are the better parts. These big, huge RAM chips from the other company took an address bit in. The address told it where in memory you're going to grab something or put it in. And inside the chip, it really took half of those address bits, the ones and zeros, half of them first, waited a while, and then used the other half. It was a two-step process inside of RAM chips. Well, the Intel chips had smaller, tinier chips, and you yourself put in half the address first and then half the address second. And it turns out that economically, for the total number of chips in an arrangement, it was a better task. The total number of wires connecting things, it was more reliable. I told Steve, "Oh, I love those chips." And he got them for free from a rep. So that was one. He was always good at figuring out whatever you can do, there's a way to do it. Get on the phone, talk to people, convince them you've got something. Now, what I did was I said, okay, these memories needed to refresh. They would forget everything they knew in a 2,000th of a second if you didn't get in about 256 times and put in certain addresses to keep them from forgetting. And I said, "Wait a minute, I already have some counters for the television counting horizontal and vertical lines 60 times a second already. So why don't I take enough of those signals and just run the wires over and send them into the chips at the right time? And I'm using the counters for the television horizontal vertical signals. I'm using those counters to tell the chips where to go in memory so they won't forget themselves." And it was great to use 2 chips at once. But on the Apple II, I took a step even further. In the early days, terminals, things that a computer could send data to a printer, maybe a teletype that somebody sat down and typed on, as expensive as a car or two. Video terminals were available. They cost as much as about 2 cars. A computer could send it an A on a slow wire and send it a B and a C and a D. They'd go across the screen very slowly. That's how you had to use it. The terminal was distant. I thought, my gosh, I've got this board here. I'm going to design this board, this Apple II. I'm going to make the computer and the video terminal one and the same. The same memory that a microprocessor can change 1,000,000 times a second, 1,000,000 numbers a second, those numbers are going to pop up on the TV screen. If you can change 1,000,000 a second, you can make animations. You can make games. This was going to change games into software forever. Computer games were born. And it was just that condensing and using one set of memory for the computer and the video rather than one for the computer, one for the video, rather than connecting them on a wire. Every time you bring things closer to the brain of a computer called the processor, you actually get more efficiency, you get better results, you get faster things done. That's true to this day in a lot of areas. I'm with a company, Fusion IO. And we're getting rid of hard disks with chips. We've been sort of the leader in the world in this field. We've gone public and been real successful, actually. But everybody else said, let's make solid-state disks. They plug in wherever a disk drive plugs in. But a disk drive always plugs into cables, usually on a big rack of equipment, and those cables go to RAID arrays, and the RAIDs have different connectors that funnel into fiber optic connectors inside of the big server computers in all the huge data centers you hear of doing the big work. Our company just said, let's spindle the board and plug it right into the server computer like Woz's floppy disk did. It brings it closer to the processor, and it allows you to write software that controls it as a disk drive or controls it as a new type of memory and lets you have a lot more options in what you can do and go a lot further. So one of the thinkings is bring things close to the processor, they always work faster. Also, it's okay to violate rules. You know, if you sit down and you're smart, and I said, write the book. Okay, television when I grew up was analog. Analog, nice little waveforms. And I had studied television. I could repair televisions and scope out all their signals. I knew how they worked. And if you wanted to generate color for color television, it cost $1,000. And the reason is you had to have these sine wave generators for red and ones for blue that were a little later, and green, red, blue, green. And then you had to multiply their amplitudes with electronics, and then you had to mix them all with differential calculus to find circuits that fed feedback loops. It was a mess to build a color generator. And one night, my head was very tired. I spent 4 nights without sleep designing a game for Atari called Breakout. And in that period, I thought I saw color on a machine, on a TV, but they only used black and white TVs for those arcade games, the early arcade games. Color, and my head popped back to what color was in the television world, the analog television world. And now I was very much a digital person, too, and I thought, what if I put 4 little ones and zeros into a chip that cost $1? I would have 16 patterns. And if I circulated that chip around and repeated those little ones and zeros at the right rate, it'd be 1100, up, down, up, down. If I did it at exactly the right rate, I realized every color television made would think it was color, generated the proper way. This had never been in a book. Never a technique, never ever, possibly in any book. It couldn't be valid. It couldn't even be allowed by a company that really existed. Couldn't be allowed as a solution in a school, and yet I knew it would work on every TV. And it would give me 16 different colors, and it did work. And that was really the highlight of the Apple II. No one ever expected color. No one expected graphics moving so fast you could actually program games in simple languages like BASIC. So it's okay to violate the rules if you got enough intelligence to know how it works. Don't think that all the answers are the ones you've read in books, because those are other people's answers. One thing about the Apple II, which really kicked off Apple as a huge company of the world, it was a very open machine. I had learned through discoveries in my life, being very shy, I could never ask people anything about computers. I knew it was the highlight of my life. Every time I saw any article or I found a journal in the hall closet without my parents knowing it, and I started reading and it had articles about computers showing how you can add ones and zeros, and little binary stuff, and what logic was about, I learned. And every time I got to see a program somebody had written in a computer manual, oh my gosh, that is how you have a computer that cannot multiply. That's how you make these additions and shifts add up to a multiply. Wow, I learned that way. I wanted the Apple II to be that sort of a product so that other young people like myself, that inside of them, they were technologists, but they had no way to get into it. Remember, when I got out of high school, it was a graduate course, was introduction to computers. That's what it was like in those days. But I wanted to have a machine that everybody could get of any age, and pull it out of the box, and start discovering, going through the manual, seeing the circuits, how it was actually designed in hardware, seeing how you plug boards in, how you have to write a little code for them and put boards together that could connect to printers of your own, start your own companies, how you could write software in different languages. Examples after example after example. Our manual, we were so open, we gave it all away. Thousands of little companies started up around the world, mostly small, little, technically interested guys, discovered with this computer, they were interested in technology, they loved computers, they knew how to do it, and they started writing programs and developing hardware. And they started little companies. It was so amazing to see all these hundreds and thousands of companies start up. And of course, every one of them was advertising for Apple. We just had built the platform, the base unit. So it was very good, and it was going to make Apple, give Apple huge revenues from, you know, from pretty much our start until about for the next 10 years, it was going to really be paying for everything in the company. And what that buys you is when you have a wealthy company, it buys you a lot of restarts. You get more tries. You can have some failures along the way, and eventually you'll usually get out of it. Because you look at a huge company and you say, oh, this company is going to be here forever. And it's amazing to see how many have been affected in our lifetime, gone away, been consumed, bought up for $1 billion, and then totally shut down. So it's a lot different than when I grew up as a kid thinking every large company just stays for hundreds of years and they can never go away. But they do have a lot of factors that will keep them alive for quite a while. And we built Apple to be a company that was going to bring this great technology to the people of the world, enhance their lives. And we wanted to be our own company and not get consumed by someone else, not get bought out. A guy named Jeff Raskin came to Steve Jobs and I at a certain point, and he pointed out that you could build two computers, and one of them, if you put a lot of extra effort in, and you make software, make it work a certain way, somebody can walk up that doesn't understand computers, and they could get, so they could use it as well as the computer expert. Now you've made the computer for everyone. And he really brought that whole philosophy of ease of computing to Steve and I and into Apple. He said the best computer in the world is one that has no manual. It's so obvious how to do things. It's intuitive. And he ran our publications department for years. And the rule was the engineers would design something. If the publications people couldn't write it in a real clearly understandable way, that meant the end user wasn't going to have a very easy time with it. So the engineers would have to redo it a different way to make it sound good to the end user. And that's so Jeff did that. And then he also started our Macintosh group. We did a lot of things making computers easier and more human for people than before. The Apple II said a computer instead of a big mainframe that looks ugly in a front panel, switches and lights, now it can look like a typewriter, and humans were familiar with typewriters. When we went down to Xerox Park Center, Jeff Raskin took Steve and I and a couple others down to Xerox Park Center, where we saw a machine with a mouse. Windows popped up. It was like you had multiple computers in one, and it had little menus would pop up to do things. It was obvious that someday computers would go that way, and Steve thought, it's today, Apple's the one to do it. It turns out we were still ahead of our time cost-wise because of what memory cost in those days. But this idea of a mouse, your eye, when it looks at a screen, doesn't see things arrow, 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 arrow in one dimension. Your eye sees things in two dimensions. You see the whole screen at once. You want to point somewhere in X and Y coordinates. And that's what a mouse allowed us to do, was to move towards the way the human eye works. Eventually, we got nice, thin LCD panels, and things were lightweight. That's very human-oriented. Humans like things that are small. Now we're touch screens, so you actually touch objects with your hand and move them as they move. In the middle there, we had a technology called drag and drop. The first real example of it was the finder of the Macintosh, you would say. You would look at an object and drag it on the screen, a little icon standing for something, and drop it into a folder, maybe just a trash can, drop it into a folder, and you'd see the origin, the destination, and the object you're moving the whole time. It's very, very good, very cognitive for people that that need a little feedback to understand things because they aren't computer experts. These were steps that Apple took all along, kind of working for the human. Jeff Raskin's philosophy was the human's more important than the technology. Modify the technology to work in human ways rather than forcing the human to work in the technology ways. When Steve Jobs was young, he was kind of had a sense of humor. He had interest in electronics and digital. He didn't have great grades in school or anything. And his mind would just flutter in every little direction. He always wanted to talk to people. Very immature sounding. We had a common interest in jokes, and we had common interest in music, for one thing, and talking about life. He was very concerned about where does life go, you know, like when you're young and you're searching for religious values and that sort of thing. Now, by the time we started Apple, Steve's personality changed. It kind of, your personality sort of settles in around age 20. And all of a sudden, he wanted to interject himself into all the high-level decisions of the company. And I wanted to avoid running a company because it's political. I just wanted to do the engineering. And so Steve had changed by then. But he was still rather immature all the way through a few failures. The Apple III was a failure. The Lisa computer with a mouse was a failure. The Macintosh was a heavy failure at the start. It took actually 3 years of incredible revenues coming from the Apple II to restore a Macintosh market, and that was without Steve there. He was gone. When Steve returned, he was a different person. He was so mature in business sense. He cared about, you know, supply chain, inventory, you know, advertising, everything you need for developers, how to create a great computer. All he needed was a company with millions of loyal buyers like Apple had. So Apple was a really good, that, you know, he spoke to me about that, that's what Apple really provided. It was the base that you could bring the good stuff to. It takes a couple of years. His first real big success all his own was the iPod. Great music device. And it went with a great music program, iTunes. Well, all of a sudden, now if we restricted that to the Macintosh owners, it'd be like 5% of the world's market. But what we did was we wrote iTunes for Windows. We went open. Instead of being restricted, you're in an Apple world, you're in a closed fence, we actually opened it up and said, we'll write iTunes for Windows, and now we could sell iPods to the entire world. And now we had two companies in one, and we were twice as big as we'd ever been before. That was a huge start. The iPhone, I think, was the greatest gadget ever made. It was just done in a secret way. It came out so different than all of the other smartphones of their time. Totally different approaches with no real physical keyboard, and it was just so different looking and operating in every sense of the way, and that can happen only when groups are allowed to isolate and develop on their own with all the freedom to do the best they can. So there was nothing ever like it. That was like really writing the book. You don't normally, that comes out of some young people with an idea of starting up a company, not from a big existing company like Apple. The next time we got open was the App Store. We went and we said, okay, we're going to let people actually write programs of their own for this iPhone. When the iPhone first came out, there was no App Store. It was just the 8 or so apps that Apple provided on the screen. You kind of used these standard ones for weather and stock, and you didn't really have it open to the rest of the world for the young technology enthusiasts to develop their own stuff. Over time, I've noticed that things tend to always want to be easier for people. For example, music quality was always related in terms of fidelity as I grew up. And you made more expensive hi-fis and they sounded better and better. Even amplification of all the notes from low to high, lower is better and higher is better. And all of a sudden, MP3s came along. Fidelity was out the door. It was ridiculous for MP3s, but they were so easy. They took over the world, and everything we'd considered quality in music before went. Computer, brain, will it ever be one? When I first wrote a program once, I discovered that this computer that could do a million things a second was going to take longer than the universe to solve a chess problem. And I said, oh my gosh, computers don't know the methods to solve problems. By a clever method, a human being could solve that problem. Only the human brain can come up with methods to solve problems. Computers can actually do the work. Got the Newton message pad, the first PDA of the world, and the first day I had it, I wrote a little note to myself. Sarah, Dennis, Tuesday, 2 p.m. I saw a button called Assist, didn't know what it did. I clicked it, it opened up my calendar, Tuesday at 2 p.m., it put in the word Dennis, and it grabbed Sarah out of my contact list. And I said, this is what I want forever. That changed my life forever. Computers that understand something that I write in the human world, to a human, I want the computers to understand it. Now we got Google. You used to ask smart people questions because they had brains. And now you ask Google, and you get back tons and tons of answers, much more than any human could give you. We didn't invent the internet to be a brain. We stumbled on it by accident. You're talking with your human voice like you're talking to other people into your cell phones now, both Google and then Siri on the Apple iPhones. And you've got programs like Google Now that are trying to think out what's appropriate for you given what it knows about your life, pulling things from your Gmail and pulling things from your Google Calendar. And that's very much like the Knowledge Navigator that our CEO at Apple, John Sculley, showed off once. A machine that sort of said, oh, by the way, John, since you're going to be near the grocery store, you might pick up some milk for the cake that you have to make because it's on your daughter's birthday party on Tuesday. And all this thinking things out for you, that's the direction of the future. We're moving closer and closer to where a machine is like a person. And we can have normal conversations with it. Someday it's probably going to be looking at my face, judging my facial expression, knowing me better than anyone else. And that's going to really help education, because now we'll be able to have one teacher per student and let students go off in their own direction. Because a computer can't do that yet. Computers aren't really that successful in changing how many people go through school successfully. You know, by the time you're 8 years old, a lot of kids have decided school's not worth it because I'm being compared to everyone else. But you never fail one teacher to one student. And a computer or an iPhone is an awfully cheap teacher, but it has to get more human in its characteristics. And that's the direction we're coming. Natural language understanding has got to get better than it is today. It's got to understand little things when people pause. Anything another human being could understand is what I want my phones to understand. It's funny, there's jokes on the internet about having trouble with Scottish language, so probably Irish too. But I was recently in the southern United States where we used to have slavery. And I spoke that I had discovered bigotry down there because Siri doesn't seem to understand southern accents well. Okay, now we're going to move on to a few questions. I think we've got some prepared questions here.
Well, first of all, fantastic. Thank you very much.
I didn't even get to the tax situation.
Yeah, just as well, maybe. Well, my first question is, how are you going to invent the alchemy of time so we can have another hour together?
I wish I had 25. Yeah, everyone wants 25th hour in a day, especially nowadays with email. Yeah.
That's the way it goes. One interesting thing, in this audience are a whole shed load of people who are trying to support, encourage, incubate innovation. Have you got a salutary piece of advice to these people, or just say, keep doing it?
Centers where people are given enough supplies and tools and allowed to work on things of their own, like the do-it-yourselfers that may have no commercial value, that's still where they develop their mindset. Employees in a company, a lot of companies will actually pay to send employees to the university to get more skills. Let them design something for themselves, for their own home, and they'll actually get better educated, some of them. You have to kind of detect who are the creative ones, the ones that really want to, you know, achieve and be among the great. I remember when I worked at Hewlett-Packard, we had a written policy. It was a great, great company with so many great policies, but a written policy that an engineer could have parts out of the storeroom for anything of his own design if his supervisor approved. So responsibility down to the lowest level in the management chain.
Okay, and keep letting people have fun. Is that right?
You know, in my life, that goes for me. I'm not convinced that some people can have fun in different ways than others. I tell jokes and laugh a lot and play tricks. And the conversations you have with your workmates, when you're working in engineering and technology, it is intense work, you know. And I guess if you're an executive, things are intense and you're constantly thinking, oh, you need those breaks because you work late at night. Sometimes we work all-nighters trying to solve problems in software or hardware. And just having a little relaxation and break and fun makes it all worthwhile. So I've always been for include fun with work.
Okay, bit of chocolate. That's the trick. Anyway, a lot of people talk about open source and interest whether kind of open source information. Trying to work that out as a profit-making business model. You got any thoughts on that?
I don't think about it in terms of profit. Obviously, I'm for open source. Because a company can manufacture a product that's open source and they'll get all their revenues for manufacturing the product, but that doesn't inhibit other smart people from extending it, making changes, adding their own touches to it. The first company, I think, certainly deserves the revenues for it all. It's hard to say. We had another device at Apple. We had a software system called... I think it was Open Something, but what it was software writers could write little individual tools, and a tool, you could grab a selection of tools and bring it into any of the programs that used this methodology and bring those tools in, and they would work the same. Somebody wrote a better tool, you'd bring their tool in for clipping or for changing fonts or whatever, and it was really good, but it didn't have a good business model associated with it, yeah.
And I'm just wondering, you're a man of vision. Can you let us into the secret of what's creeping over the hill? Where's the next layer of innovation?
Sure.
Beyond where we think it is.
Yeah, I think we're going to go in for a couple of decades in this towards more like our mobile devices seeming more like real humans. But obviously, you know, just I read the same things as everyone else, you know, and I couldn't guess beyond that. But for many, many years, I've been hoping we'd finally get these organic LED displays that were foldable. And I want to see objects like you're used to a globe being a round circle. And I want to see a globe that's glowing. And it's Google Earth, and you can zoom in on parts of it with your fingers because it fits the human style of looking at a really round globe better than a flat screen even. I'd love to get low cost plastics that I can put on the side of my car and push buttons inside to change the color of my car or make it look like a cop car. And wearable technology is one of the ones we're hearing so much about lately. And I am getting so jealous. I don't know if the marketing plan was just right to hit somebody like myself or not, but the people who have Google Glasses, I haven't had time to be a full explorer with that, so I didn't get the Google Glasses yet. But boy, that's starting to seem like an interesting thing that I sure want to try. But I also don't mind the idea of a watch, as long as the watch is my smartphone, that I can basically do all my smartphone stuff, including asking Siri questions. Wouldn't mind a watch. But if a watch is, all it's going to be is pretty much music and measuring, you know, how many steps I walk per day, that wouldn't be enough.
That's fantastic. Well, there we are. There's 15 ideas. You're going to be around with us, I think, for the rest of the morning out the back and maybe lunchtime.
Well, I definitely want to catch Tim Schmidt.
Yeah. So if you want to hook up and see whether you want to do a deal with this guy to take some of those ideas forward, then this morning's your opportunity.
Certainly. We're going to have a break now, and we're going to have a lunch, and I'll be for both.
And this guy only says yes, so that's the secret. Ladies and gentlemen, Steve Wozniak, once again. Thank you very much indeed. Brilliant.